Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer, thanks for joining us today. We are going to start the show by talking about transitioning your plants from your garden indoors to protect them from the winter weather. Of course, we'll take all your gardening questions as we move along today because we have a great expert for you. Melinda Myers back with us, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host. Over 20 books she's written. And she has been an integral part of not only Garden Talk, but gardening in general across our state and throughout the Midwest at least. Questions for her, I hope you'll join in. You have a question about transitioning plants, other gardening question on your mind, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
This is the time of the year we ought to be thinking about transitioning plants inside from being outdoors all summer. Most plants don't react particularly well when they first come.
That's a very nice way of saying it, Larry. Every year, I swear, in March, I'm not bringing plants in because I'm sweeping leaves off the floor, right, battling some insects, and I'm not going to do it. But every year, gardeners were like, I might not be able to find this, or I have this beautiful elephant ears on my front porch that's doing great, and I'm like, it's been getting kind of chilly. I need to bring it in. And it's too nice to let it go and just store as a bulb over winter. So, yes, it's a couple things. If you haven't already brought yours in, some people are ahead of the game. I'm, of course, the one that waits as long as possible. If you can quarantine those plants, you know, if you have a room, if you have other plants in your house, if you have a room where you don't have other indoor plants, that you can move them, or you have a screened in, or actually like a sunroom that you can bring them in for a few weeks, monitor for insects. You know, you might even want to hose them off in case there's possibly any aphids or mites on there, and then monitor them for a couple of weeks. I'm big with using organic insect controls, and only if needed. You know, if you have pets or kids or grandkids, you know, they're always very curious, so keeping them safe is important. And so then I try to enlist, if I find a problem, the old-fashioned yellow sticky traps. You know, you may remember from years ago, they're popular again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they help us monitor things, you know, fungus, gnats, adults, even some of the other insects, whiteflies attracted to that yellow, and they stick. And then you decide, okay, is that controlling it enough, or do I need to implement something? Insecticidal soap, or I'm a fan of lightweight horticulture oil like Summit year-round spray oil, because it kills the egg, the larvae, and the adult. And you have to repeat, just because it's organic, it doesn't kill, you know, it kills what it controls. The same with insecticidal soap, what it contacts. But if, say, an insect walks across the treated leaf, it won't kill it. So you have to monitor and be prepared to do it again if necessary. Some people will shower their house plants. You know, I like to try to do it outside, but I have been known to put some plants in the sink or the shower, just cover the soil so I don't end up with dirt in the plumbing. And that's a nice way to, a good start for managing those insects. And then if you can put them in the brightest indoor location you have, and if that's not where they're going to stay, after a couple weeks, move them to the next brightest and then to their final location. And consider adding artificial lights. Our winter days are short and often gray. And I know you had a lime plant for many years.
Yep.
And I think you supplemented your day, the sunlight, with some artificial light as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I used a pole lamp. And I had light.
Oh.
I had, you know, so they were getting like Limey was getting three shots, you know, from all aspects of the plant.
Which is great because a lot of the things we bring in are big. And
yeah.
So if we shine just from above, the top leaf do well. But if you can have a pull light, that's a great option. And a lot of these lights you can buy are decorative. So you could even have them in your living room, not just in that room where nobody uses, right? And people are like, are you crazy?
Well, I tell you what, and watering, do we need to water?
Oh, great question. So adjust your watering. You're moving them indoors. If you keep your house cool, even though the humidity is lower in winter, it's not as low as the folks that keep their house really warm. And so you want to adjust your watering schedule accordingly. I'm a big fan of, I use my finger as my moisture meter until I get used to, okay, kind of reading the soil, sticking it in a couple inches. The moisture meters have improved. I typically still trust my finger and visual assessment best. But everybody's different. Not everyone likes to stick their finger in the soil. A good friend of mine used to use chopsticks, kind of like you test your cake batter to see if it's done. And he'd stick the chopstick in. And if there's moisture in there, the soil, the potting mix will stick to that. So if you don't like to use your finger and you don't have a moisture meter, you might want to check that. If you keep your house hot, though, you know, you might be watering fairly often. Cacti and succulents, bright location, they like to go drier in the winter, and you may be rewarded with flowers by keeping them cool, the soil a little drier in winter, and you might just get some flowers come spring.
That sounds like a fun thing to do. Valerie emailed us to ask, what are the best methods to have the healthiest and longest living mums?
You know, first of all, it starts with getting a good hearty mum. I'm a fan of the mums that were introduced from the University of Minnesota. They're Zone 3 hardy. I first saw them at the Green Bay Botanic Garden, and I have some of them. The mammoth mum, I don't know how available they'll be in the future. Someone told me no one picked up the patent, but there's a lot of good hearty mums. If you can plant in the spring and get the plants established, and more garden centers are selling mums and asters in the spring, often in bloom, so you can put them in the garden, get the roots established come fall, and then they'll bloom for you in the fall, but they're established. We buy them now, right? And they're putting all their energy into the blooms, not the roots. And I always tell people, you know, I buy mums and asters every fall, put them on my porch, put them in the garden. If they make it, great. If not, I used it as an annual. I had low expectations.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. It almost feels like there's a law in the state of Wisconsin about if you have a porch, you must apply mums to the porch along with pumpkins.
I am a Wisconsinite. Let me tell you, I got pumpkins on my steps, and I have an aster, and I have a mum. I also have a sedum and some, coral bells. And then a few of my summer containers, too, because I just can't give them up yet. So I think you're right. That's kind of a requirement.
I was looking up a pumpkin. I thought, you know what? You know, it's that time of the year. I ought to look up and see how many pumpkins are produced in the U.S. And we grow, and you may know this already, but the 2025 figure is we grow over 800 million pumpkins in the U.S. just for the decorations. And that's 80% of the 1.5 billion pounds of pumpkins grown each year. So 200 million pumpkins go for other things, but 800 million of them go to sit on your front porch steps and mine.
I didn't know that. That's a fun fact to know. And I know the other thing to keep in mind, too, is recycling those pumpkins, right? I know some people put them out for wildlife, you know, away from their gardens, hoping they eat those instead of their garden plants, or composting them. You know, at least it's a biodegradable decoration, right? So if you feel guilty picking and displaying, it might be one thing to think in mind. I tried a new 2025 pumpkin. Ball Seed gave me a plant to try called Patch for Kids. And they're small size, medium size pumpkins with a really thick, durable stem. so easy for kids to handle and strong. So, you know, the worst thing you can do is pick up a pumpkin by the stem, right? And
yeah.
The pumpkin stays on the ground. And so I had like 8 pumpkins from this one plant, and they looked great. And so, you know, we have to celebrate. I have to brag when it works, because I always tell you when it fails. So this was a success. But I was excited because they're just the perfect size for kids, and that's what's sitting on my front porch, too.
Well, you know, I also read about disposing of pumpkins, and someone recommended finding a woods or a field near you, smash them open and leave. You should smash them open for the wildlife to eat. Pumpkins are safe, of course, and the seeds. Here's something I didn't know. The seeds act as a natural dewormer.
Oh, I didn't know that either. I've eaten those. So does that work for people, too? I don't know.
I don't know, but my jaw dropped when I read that.
I have lots of great material, thanks to you, Larry. This is excellent.
Well, let's get back to the transitioning, and we got to transition the outside plants as well in some ways, do we not? Protect those?
Oh, you bet. So one of the things, we had a pretty wet winter through most of the state. Some of us, it's been a little dry recently, and it's cooler. We don't think about our plants needing watering, but especially if you're doing fall planting, whether it's bulbs or perennials or getting those last plants in the ground, which is what a lot of us, myself included, are busy doing. I know there's some rain in the forecast, but kind of keep an eye on the weather, because water and mulch are the two most important things we can do to help our plants through winter. Not overwatering, but making sure they have sufficient water to get those roots established on new plantings, moisture lovers, priority, but even existing plants. And then mulching the soil surface, if it isn't already, insulates the roots. So when we have extreme temperatures, and the last two winters we've had warm and cold and warm and cold, and that causes frost heaving. So the soil shifts. So if we can keep it kind of consistent, it's easier on our plants. Pull that mulch away from the trunk of the tree, the stems of your shrubs, the crowns of your perennials. That will also help in terms of the voles are really love that mulch. And if it's up against the trunk, they have nice protection and an easy place to get food. So we want to keep it back for the voles that are busy all winter. If you have things that the critters like, this is where you prioritize, right? If you can do fencing around your new plantings, like a 4-foot high sunk in the ground will help with voles and rabbits until the snow gets high. Deer, you might want to put it wider so they can't get to the plant. Tall is good, but most of us probably aren't going 7 or 8 feet tall. But if you could have a wide berth around your plants, that can help. Small areas, the University of Minnesota found an 8x13 or smaller garden. You only need a 5-foot high, I think they said 4, I'm a little skeptical, so I'm saying 5-foot high fence around that smaller area tends to keep the deer out. And then, of course, repellents. If you know, they love hydrangeas. My panicle hydrangeas were safe for years, and they found them, and so I have to treat if I want flowers and a full-size plant the following year. So if you can treat before they start feeding, that works well. A lot of people know I'm a fan of plant skid. It's a rain and snow resistant repellent, so I don't have to replace it as often, and I've had good luck. So, you know, repetition, read the label. Depending on the product you use, it'll tell you how often to apply. But if you can apply before they start eating, you have much more effective control. And the ground's not frozen yet, so you can still keep planting in my book.
Absolutely. You know, as you were talking about mulch, I was thinking about Brussels sprouts, because if this might not be a bad time to mulch Brussels sprouts, keep the soil warmer longer.
You actually get a crop?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
You know, that is a good that. That's a good point, because anybody growing Brussels sprouts, I've had a couple of really good years. This is not one of them for me. But they are a long season plant. And you're right. If you can mulch the soil, fall leaves are an excellent mulch in the garden. And you can leave them in place. They are very good at suppressing weeds, conserving moisture. And that's a great idea, Larry, because, you know, the tops of the Brussels sprouts can take it down into the high 20s, you know, even 26, 28 degrees, and it really makes the flavor even sweeter. But if you can keep the root system a little warmer, longer, you're right, you're going to extend that harvest time or that growing time for a better harvest.
Melinda Myers, our guest, great to have her back to talk about all things in the garden, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. Number to call, get you on pretty quickly, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Melinda Myers for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Coming up in the last half hour of the show today, we'll be talking about seed saving and with a couple of folks from the Oshkosh Seed Savers. They've got kind of a really cool thing going on there. And so we'll learn about that the last half hour of the show. Right now, we're taking all kinds of gardening questions from our guest today, Melinda Myers. Always great to have her back with us. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Tammy in Merrill, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. So I received a number of beautiful succulents from my mother-in-law in Iowa. And last year, I did not do well with taking them inside the home over the winter. And she recommended I keep them in our cool garage for the winter. So I'm calling to see what advice I can get.
Do you know what kind, Tammy, are they like hens and chicks? Do you know if they're basically hardy succulents? Because there are some succulents that will survive our winters in the garden or a cool garage. But there are some that really can't, depending on how cold your garage gets. They may not make it. Do you have any idea the types of succulents they are? The names of any of them?
I know it's... Yes, there are some that are kind of hardy. They are a mixture of hen and chicks, and then a couple of different taller ones that don't seem so hardy. So they're kind of a combination.
Excellent. So I would say if you have an unheated garage, I have pretty good success overwintering things. I usually bring my hens and chicks into a very cool place with good bright light for winter, and they do okay. You would be okay for anything that's hardy in our area in an unheated garage. What I like to do, I have that couple-inch thick insulation that you can get at like a big box store or home improvement place, and I've made a floor, and then kind of an open box where I'll put things that I'm overwintering in, things that are generally hardy if they were planted in the ground. So your hens and chicks could do okay. I will insulate the roots with additional air either by putting other pots around it or bags of shredded paper, which I always seem to have, something to insulate the roots. You could even just take a styrofoam cooler or just, a box and fill it with some kind of insulating material and set your pots inside for those things that are hardy. The ones that aren't reliably hardy for our area, you're taking a chance. And so, you know, your mother-in-law gave them to you and suggested how to take care of them. So hopefully if they don't make it, you won't feel quite as bad, right? And she won't get mad at you. But I'm a little worried about the ones that aren't hardy. If you do decide to do it, you know, maybe the wall next to your house, if it's an attached unheated garage. The problem with heated garages is they're pretty warm, and so things need bright light to grow, and so that makes it challenging to keep up going. So definitely the hardy ones, I think you'd have great success. The borderline hardy ones, it's iffy, but I've had people tell me they've overwintered plants I never thought would have survived in a garage in Wisconsin. So you might have luck with it. And I just kind of keep some records and You know, where did it work and what position in the garage, away from the door, protected from the open door, close to the house, that kind of thing. But definitely the hens and chicks will be fine. But the others might be a little bit risky to do that way.
Okay. Tammy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Patty in Green Bay. Hi, Patty.
Hi. When I was young, we planted tulips outside, and they came back every year. And if I go to my mom's, they're still coming back every year. But I cannot for the life of me get my tulips to come back. Even if the deer don't eat them, I can't get them to come back the next year.
I hear you. So one of the problems for us with tulips, or the new varieties especially, they're bred to be very floriferous. So they put on a good show for a year, maybe two. And after that, you're right, we get leaves, maybe we get a few flowers, if any. And that's why you see a lot of commercial landscapers managing commercial properties, where they'll dig the bulbs up at the end of the bloom time, because they know they're not going to be reliable enough for that customer. So what you want to do, I remember in the 80s, there was a big push for perennializing tulips, and we're all like, well, the tulips aren't perennial. What do you mean? Well, these were species tulips, like Tulipa tarda, or the Darwin series, or the Greggiais. The species tulips tend to be longer lived. So when you're looking for tulips to purchase, you may want to end up ordering some as well. And a lot of their descriptions will say perennializing or reliable for many years, but they're the species varieties. And some of those even reseed. I love Tulipa tarda. It's a short season of bloom. It's a smaller plant. It produces these attractive seed pods. And you let the seeds drop to the soil. The first year, the plants look like grass. It takes about 3 or 4 years for them to start blooming. But if you have a spot, it's kind of fun to watch the progress. So it's nothing you're doing wrong. It's just that a lot of the new varieties aren't bred to be long-lived, but rather very floriferous. Plus, if you think about where they're bred in the Pacific Northwest and Holland, the summers tend to be cooler, at least used to be cooler than ours. And tulips really like cold winters, not quite as cold as ours. That's why we put them down 6 inches at least. And then in the summer, dry but cool conditions. And so that also leads to longevity. But the species tulips, you know, just kind of look for those and you'll have much better luck. And then, like you said, you need to make sure that you protect them from the squirrels digging them and the deer and rabbits eating the blooms and that type of thing.
Yeah, we probably had like last winter where we didn't have any snow in many areas of the state when we had those really cold temperatures. I would imagine they did in some of those bulbs.
You bet. And that was one of the things that I think surprised a lot of people, you know, and I hate, as much as I don't like shoveling snow either, but boy, when we have cold, if we have a layer of snow, it really insulates our plants. And so I think we've also are in this changing climate that we have to just start kind of taking some note. What's doing well? What's surviving? You know, sometimes those plants that were reliable and year after year are struggling with this crazy winter weather we've had and extreme heat. Anybody growing hardy hibiscus, I can't tell you how many emails I got going, are yours up? Mine aren't up yet. Are yours up? Mine aren't up. And I'm like, I'm not even going out there because I don't want to be stressed. I'll wait a while. And they were very late coming up, some of them, not all, but some were very late emerging this year. And so patience, but also starting to evaluate what's doing well.
Well, Patty, thanks again for calling. Let's go to Susan in Manitowoc next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a hydrangea question.
Okay.
Last year, we planted an eastern snowball, I think it's called, one that gets big. It gets 10 or 12 feet tall. It bloomed beautifully last year. Its second year, it kept growing, but we got one blossom.
Ooh.
You don't know the botanical name by any chance, do you?
I do not.
Okay. So something 10 or 12 feet tall makes me think of a panicle-type hydrangea, but they have more cone-shaped flowers than the round ones. The fact it says Eastern snowball, I'm wondering if it was one of the big leaf hydrangeas that have round flowers. Were they white, pink, or blue, the flowers?
They were white.
They were white, and they were round.
The flowers, you mean? Yes.
Yes, I'm sorry, yeah. Okay. There's also our native smooth hydrangeas. So the reason I'm going here is, so panicle and smooth hydrangeas bloom on new growth. So, you know, they'll put out new growth in the spring. That new growth will develop flower buds, and we'll start seeing flowers mid to late, you know, sometimes early, but, you know, late spring into fall, depending on which one and the variety, you know. And so that's fine. But the big leaf hydrangeas, which typically aren't 10 to 12 feet tall. However, we've had some really wet weather that some of my plants have doubled in size just because of the weather. They bloom on old wood, so they've set their flower buds for next year already. We have a cold winter, like Larry described last winter, really cold weather followed by warm. We can have some damage to those flower buds. Repeat blooming big leaf hydrangeas are supposed to bloom on old wood. They've set their flower buds for the first flush of flowers, but then on the new growth have another flush. But one of the things we found with these repeat bloomers, they've been somewhat disappointing. I've tried a variety, and if you want 100% success, you'll be very frustrated for the most part. You know, there are some that seem to be doing better, Popstar, Summer Crush, but it's variable. So a couple of things. Without knowing exactly, so if you can find the tag, look for hydrangea macrophylla. There are some white blooming types like Blushing Bride. Arborescence is the smooth hydrangea. This is way more information than you probably wanted. And I don't think it's a paniculata panicle hydrangea, just for the description of the flowers. Too much fertilizer, too much nitrogen, not enough light. Most of the smooth hydrangeas are shade tolerant, but there is a point where there's not enough. So watch your fertilization. A lot of times with flowering plants, we buy them in bloom. They're in a pot. It's signaling I'm mature. I can flower. We plant them. We get blooms the first year. The next year, the plant puts its energy into forming roots instead of sending it into flowering. That's a possibility as well. So you might want to, you know, it may be that. And then a soil test is always a great place to start. If your other plants in the area are blooming, it's probably just that the plant's getting established. If you think it needs fertilize, I'm a big fan of low nitrogen, slow release. A lot of you know I use Milorganite. It has phosphorus that's non-leaching. It promotes bloom because it helps take the phosphorus and potassium, make it available to the plant, that phosphorus and potassium bound to the soil. Just one application in the spring if you think it needs a nudge. But, you know, if the plant's healthy, you might want to just hold off on fertilizing till you get soil test results or kind of monitor the health. So if you can find the tag, that's going to help you a lot and hopefully avoid over-fertilizing. And again, maybe hopefully you'll have some blooms next year as the plant's moving from establishing roots to starting to bloom.
There you go, Susie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Good information there. Andrea in Madison, your turn. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. You were talking about perennial tulips, and I do love those species. They're really, really lovely, delicate, beautiful little things. But if you were looking for a classic tulip that's going to perennialize, the one that I would recommend is Banja Luka. Two words. It is a brute of a tulip. The flower is very large. The plant is very large. It's yellow with red flares. And it actually got to be weedy in my veg garden. I had a bunch of tulips in there for cutting. And Banja Luka started spreading and spreading, and every year it was back. It was a brute of a tulip. I've never seen anything like it.
Banja
Luka.
Thank
you for that.
Have you ever
tried
that?
I have not. I took a note. I guess I need to add some. I do need to treat because the squirrels have found my tulips. But that's great. Thank you for sharing that. That's wonderful. That's what I love doing the show with you, Larry. I always learn something from you and your listeners, too.
Andrea, thanks a lot. Banja Luka.
Luka.
Yeah.
Next year, everybody will have planted it. We'll be sharing, right?
Oh, my goodness. You can join in, too, by the way. Well, open lines get you on pretty quickly here. The number is 800-642-1234. Of course, you can email to talk at WPR.org, but we'll get you on pretty quickly with a phone call. Melinda, we have someone who emailed in with wanting your suggestions for bringing outdoor succulents inside. Will I bring a lot of bugs in, I guess is the question, and that could spread to my indoor plants.
You know, that's always the take we have. That's always part of the decision, is saving the plant over winter and taking that chance. Anytime we bring plants indoors, we're taking a chance of bringing insects in with it. You know, outside we've got birds, we've got better weather, the plants are tougher, they're more resistant. So a lot of times you're like, well, I didn't see any insects. We bring them in, the air is hot and dry. I forgot to mention increasing the humidity for the benefit of your plants, but then the insects really thrive and our plants struggle. Definitely look, mealybug is a problem. It's those cottony little, you know, they're insects that suck plant juices. It's a soft scale that's covered with like a cottony fibrous thing. Hard to control, just like regular scale. And so that's a great question, because it's, you know, is it worth saving, or are you better off composting and starting with fresh plants next year? And only you can make that decision. And also the tolerance. You know, I had scale, bad infestation of scale. I had some plants in my shop. I have a great window. I keep it cool, and I store things and do some video shooting up there. And every year I put them out, and the birds kind of manage them to a level that the plants are fine, put them in. They struggle, but they were separate from my plants that I keep indoors year-round. You know, so that's kind of a way to avoid it, if you can isolate them and reduce that risk. But it is challenging. So I think if you can check and monitor, succulents are very sensitive with pesticides, insecticides, even organic. So always test a leaf or two before you treat the whole plant, if you decide to treat the plant. Mealybugs, you know, a cotton swab dipped in alcohol, touch each one. Some people will spray with an alcohol solution. That always makes me nervous. But again, test the leaf before you do it if you're concerned. But I'm a believer that look for the problem before you treat. Especially organics aren't going to help if the insect isn't present. So it's kind of one of those, what's the risk worth? How much, you know, do you have a really extensive indoor plant collection? Maybe you don't want to risk it, and it's better off not bringing them in. So how's that for really not answering the question?
Oh, there you go. On that note, we'll turn to Mike in Algoma. How about that? Mike,
okay.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, I got your tree question. Just recently, I thought I knew everything, but I guess I don't. What do you think about using hormones to help tree growth?
You know, I'm a big believer. Well, and believe me, I don't know everything. I always learn something new every time I talk to a gardener or listen to a professional or garden, right? So they use growth hormones a lot in greenhouses, a very controlled environment, some to prevent growth, some to encourage growth. Mycorrhiza, there's some controversy about adding mycorrhiza to the soil to help promote healthy growth and rooting. Really, a lot of the research points to proper watering and mulch as your key to encourage good growth. The other thing that is often overlooked is the bigger the mulch area. I know people are like, I'll see trees with a 1 foot circle of mulch around them. When I was teaching at Milwaukee Area Technical College, I taught tree and shrub ID, and we looked at this catalpa, and my students were like, well, that looks like a bush. That doesn't look like a tree. So we extended the mulch bed extensively, and it was the summer of 1995, which was hot and dry. Nobody was watering that plant during the summer. It put on a foot of growth just by pulling the grass, removing the grass, which is a big competitor for water and nutrients. We extended that mulch bed, and that made a huge difference. And so I think you'd be better off trying to manage with that. The other thing I'm going to say is there's so much information on the internet, some good, some people do something once and say it's a success and it may have been a coincidence. I always look for university-based researched information. I was an extension agent, so that's kind of where my background comes from. The International Society of Arboriculture funds a lot of research, and on their Trees Are Good website, there's a lot of good information as well. So I haven't seen any research on, they were doing like growth regulators in the past to manage trees under utility lines and to reduce pruning. I haven't seen as much hormones used to manage fruit or prevent fruit production. So, I'm going to do a little research too, but I have not read anything recently about that. And everything I see is it's about proper care, getting the grass back and mulching just to insulate those roots, or growing perennial ground covers underneath that are less competitive for water and nutrients.
Yeah. Mike, thank you very much for calling. Nancy in Waukesha, we'll go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I have an asparagus patch that's about 25 feet by 6 foot. And I've had that patch there for many years. And as I'm getting a little older, I'm kind of getting tired of pulling weeds out of that thing. And I'm also don't want to really start putting down a mulch bed in there, because you always have to replace that as well. So I was wondering, what kind of like cover crop, low grow kind of thing could I put in there that would help the asparagus? They get along real good together, and it would help you.
Help with the weed protection from this. I think we kind of lost Nancy there for a second. What do you think, Melinda?
You know, I'm going to be really honest. I'm just starting a lot with cover cropping, and I just read a book called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden. It's going to be out in November by Elliot Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. Now, I have to say most of the beginning of the book is a lot of references to organic gardening and the start, and interesting, but don't give up. Keep going through. And then he talks a lot about cover crops, you know, and things that you can do. Clover is very, very aggressive, so that's going to end up being, you know, a weed in your garden and something else to manage. Buckwheat is often used as a temporary one. And we're seeing, and I'm like kind of flipping through this book. So one of the things he talked about was, which was very interesting, is some of the weeds, and I have plenty of those, that actually provide good root growth. And things like Galinsago, you don't want to plant it, and you want to manage it before it goes to seed. But I would check this out, and I'm just hesitant to say a lot in terms of what would be a good one. But buckwheat has good competition for the weeds, and that's a good one that you might want to try. I know mustard is an annual one that they're using a lot. And so a lot of these are kind of more you know, vetch is one, but that makes me nervous because I have plenty of vetch I'm trying to manage. So you might want to try some buckwheat. I have an asparagus patch too, and it's, you know, the quackgrass gets in. I've got strawberries that have invaded it, which not bad, but it's not helping my asparagus. So you might want to check out buckwheat. But I would say do some research, because, and I'm working on that myself, so I'm pleading new to this whole thing, because green manure crops and cover crops are so different, and there's such limited information. And I don't know if you've got any guests coming up, Larry, but that'd be great. And I'd want to know when they're on, so I'm sure to tune in. But you might want to check that out.
Yeah, cover crops. I'm not sure if we've got anything scheduled on that or not. Jeff's making a note of it, so we'll see what we can come up with. Nancy, thank you very much for calling. And just as a side note, somebody told me once you ought to cut back your asparagus ferns and get rid of them because that'll help with the insect and disease problems this time of year.
Yes. Good question. You know, I used to be a leave-them-stand for winter. They capture the snow. You know, it insulates the roots. But if you've got asparagus beetle, the best way to manage them is exactly what you're saying, is to cut them back. Once they yellow, cut them back because they overwinter in that debris. And I need to do that because I've got asparagus beetles in my patch. So thank you for bringing that up, Larry. I couldn't help really well with a cover crop. I do have some buckwheat I'm planting. It's a little late, but I'm still going to try to get some down before the snow flies this year or the ground freezes.
Okay. Melinda Meyer is our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along today on Garden Talk as we talk pretty much everything in the garden today with our guest, Melinda Meyer. It's always great to have her with us. Tim in Madison has something for us, so let's go there. Tim, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Melinda. I've been listening to both of you guys for years and have great respect. But I have to tell a horrible story about fruit flies, or I don't even know if they were fruit flies. But my wife wanted to move a bunch of plants indoors this year because she thought with the changing climate, maybe she could see what could make it. And we got this terrible infestation, and it seemed like there was nothing we could do. We covered the soil. We you know, all the things that she did, I shouldn't say I did, that she did. But finally, what came down to solving it, and I don't know if you guys have tried this, but we just took a Tupperware top and put it over the two drainage things in the kitchen sink. Because we had, everybody knows, cover the kitchen sink drain, but duh, we hadn't covered the other one. And they're connected. And so make sure when you cover the one drain, cover the other drain. And that solved the problem totally. So.
Thank you so much. This is fruit fly season, right? Because we've got all our vegetables we bring in and, you know, getting them used in a timely manner. And I remember if either it was Phil Pelletieri or P.J. Leash that once said, getting rid of fruit flies is pretty tough. And you found the source. The point was they're a lot of times living in that drain. It's moist. There's that debris from the veggies. So thank you for that. Fungus gnats are different. And maybe we'll give a shout out to fungus gnats. They don't hurt the plants. Usually we don't have populations. They feed on the organic matter in the soil. They look like fruit flies, but they're smaller. They're in your face, on your computer screen, by your lights, in the windows. And again, they don't harm the plants, but they lay their eggs in the potting mix. The eggs hatch, the larvae eat the organic matter, then they pupate and become adults. So the yellow sticky traps will trap the adults. The good news is mosquito bits are now licensed for use on fungus gnats, and you soak the bits. They have a corn carrier, so I used to just apply them to the soil, but sometimes mold grows on the corn, doesn't hurt the plant, but is annoying. So you soak them water with that, and that will kill the larvae. But you have to repeat once a week for several weeks. And anytime you bring a new plant in or a new potting mix, if it's not sterile, you might be bringing the fungus gnats in. So, Tim, the fruit fly, great advice. Thank you, because they are annoying. And I have to say I have a few in my kitchen, so I'm going to follow your advice here.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Lisa in Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I don't know. Maybe I have the wrong type of question, but I have a tree in my backyard, and the previous tree had carpenter ants, but at this point, I'm trying to get grass to grow underneath the shade, and it won't do it. And I'm just wondering if there's any particular plant or something that I could put underneath there, like maybe ivy or something along that type of thing.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent question, and you are in the right place. I am a certified arborist. I don't do the pruning, so don't call me to come prune your big trees. But a couple things. Grass likes full sun. There are some more shade-tolerant mixes that you probably tried. I had a guy one time I was answering questions, and, you know, somebody said, I can't get grass to grow. And I said, oh, it really needs full sun. Let's do some shade-tolerant ground covers. And this man in line goes, oh, I get it to grow. And I said, well, what's your secret? I plant it every spring. That's an annual. So I'm too lazy. So, Lisa, I'm with you. Let's talk about some perennial ground cover. So one of my favorites is Epimedium, E-P-I-M-E-D-I-U-M, or barren wort. It has heart-shaped leaves. It blooms early in the season as the leaves emerge, and they have a little red tinge. They turn green. Nice, delicate look. In the fall, they turn red. A few leaves persist over winter. So that's Epimedium. And that one takes dry conditions. So once established, you know, under the tree, you've got some fairly dry conditions, lack of water reaching the ground, and then what does the tree takes up? Coral bells. Look for those that are shade tolerant. I've seen people make like a tapestry under their plant. Beautiful, because of all the different colors of the leaves. So coral bells would be another one. Brunnera, B-R-U-N-N-E-R-A, or Siberian bug loss. Several different varieties. I like Jack Frost. Queen of Hearts is nice. Somewhat heart-shaped leaves, green with a silver overlay of variegation. Blue forget-me-not like flowers in the spring, but the leaves persist all summer, so you get that nice brightening of the shade. Of course, hostas, and there are thousands to choose from. And one of my other favorites, if you want some height, is Solomon seal, the variegated Solomon seal. It's a taller plant, so you can get some height and vertical interest. Green leaves with just a light creamy edge, white flowers, red berries, don't eat, they're poisonous, and yellow fall color. So there's lots of choices that you could do, and I probably said those too fast for you. My apologies, Lisa. But lots of different options. I have done some on my website. I do have, actually, I did a shade-tolerant plants or shade, creating a shade garden, and the webinar and the handout are still available to watch. And the handout gives a lot of detail in mentioning these plants as well. So you might want to check that out. You can go to my website under upcoming webinars and appearances, learn on demand, click on that, and then just go through until you find the one you want. But the handout's free to download. The recording's still on there. So you might want to check that out, too, as you're planning to make changes.
And if you want to listen again to this show, you can wait about 2 hours once the show is over, and we have it up on WBR.org/Larry, that as well. Lisa, thank you. Janice in Antioch, Illinois, have you got a quick question for us?
Yes. Years ago, I had a peach tree, I had apple tree, and I had a plum tree. And I cut off the suckers that were growing on the spring branches.
Yeah.
And I stuck them into our ditch. And then when I had to cut the ditch, I pulled out the branches, and they had roots on them. And I wanted to know, they were light, thin roots, not real heavy roots. And I was wondering if I had left them in, would they have gotten bigger, heavier roots and grown into trees?
A great question. And yes, you know, when I moved from my city lot out to where I'm at now, I dug up an old rose, and I just had chunks, and I kind of put them on the ground, and I thought, okay, well, they'll break down. And they ended up rooting, and I have a big rose thanks to that poorly propagated but successful attempt. So, yes, you could. Now, a lot of fruit trees, however, are grafted. So what you take may or may not have survived. So they may be grafted on a dwarfing rootstock, sometimes a little bit hardier. But, yes, that would be a possibility, which probably would have been a problem if you had all those trees growing in your ditch. But, yes, one way to propagate trees is from cuttings, not it's illegal to propagate patented plants, and we want to keep our breeders working and introducing new things. And again, some of those fruit trees are grafted onto a different rootstock. But yes, I think you could have had great success.
Janice, thank you very much for calling. Melinda Myers will be with us for another half hour on the show. We will be taking a quick look now for the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the WPR News, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, gardening expert Melinda Myers. And as we talk with her, join in with your own garden questions. Number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And we have Tyson from Madison online with a question. Let's go there. Tyson, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Larry. Yeah, I have a bunch of fruit trees that have like weird fungus or like mold issues or something. I don't really know what it is, and I'm trying to figure out what would be a good alternative, like an organic kind of fungicide or something. Let's see, I have two apple trees, two peach trees, a plum tree, an Asian pear tree, and a cherry tree. And it's like, you know, each of them has something different. Like the Asian pear tree has black spots on the leaves. The peach trees get leaf curl. The apple trees get like that little copper like spots on them. And then like this weird tentacly like fungus looking thing growing on the leaves. And the plum tree has like black knots on the wood.
I think you got it covered, Tyson, and yeah, I hear you. I have apples and peaches as well. So a couple things. So the apples, it sounds like it's cedar apple rust, and so that disease spends half its life on the apple tree, the other on red cedars, which is really a juniper. And you, great description, kind of that rusty looking, and then they send out these little tentacle-looking things that release spores to infect the other plant. So we see the junipers in the spring, we have a warm rain like late May, and all these galls that have been on the tree over winter kind of explode, and they have these little gelatinous tentacles that release spores that infect the apples. So think about our last couple years, really a lot of wet spring weather, which is good for a lot of disease problems. So raking and getting rid of the leaves that are infected is a way to reduce the problem. Eliminating it is to get rid of one of the hosts, but often that cedar tree is on somebody else's property, so it's usually not too easy to do that. There are some organic fungicides. Timing is critical, and I'll get back to that in a minute. So for the Asian pear, you might have apple scab. I have a crab apple that came with my house, and so it's always my good monitor of how bad apple scab is. And I remember Brian Huddleston of the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab said last year was like the worst apple scab year he'd ever seen. And I would agree looking at my tree and all the calls I got. So that's caused by, again, cool, wet weather in the spring, a fungal disease that overwinters and leaf debris on the ground, pretty ever present. So for those two, as well as the leaf curl on the peach, if you've had it once, it may be, it is I'm pretty sure it's a fungal disease, and using a dormant oil sometimes will help, a spray early in the season. Usually not deadly. I had brown rot on my peaches, and that's where I lost a lot of my fruit, which I do need to do cleanup and sanitation. We'll leave the plum with the black knot for a minute. So what I'd recommend is on the UW, and you're going to have to help me because I know they are going through changes, but UW Learning Center still, if you just do UW Madison Apple Pest Control, that'll get you to a great publication that talks about timing. I know University of Minnesota and Chicago Botanic Garden have been doing research on organic controls. There are some organic fungicides available. Timing is critical. And usually the timing is when the buds are starting, the flower buds are starting to show color and then repeating as needed. So you might, the publication from UW tell you the timing and what to spray. So that would help with those problems if you decide to spray. The plum is black knot, and that's a common disease on plums and cherries. And they're very susceptible when you get these knots on the branches and the stems. Not a lot of good effective control on those. Pruning out before they turn black and release spores, which is usually around the middle of April, can help reduce the spread. But there's so many wild plums out there that we see it. It's hard to control the inflow of fungal spores. So my recommendation is to get a hold. They have, UW has publications on all of these, managing pests, right?
Yeah, and I think the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, if you go there, Brian has got a big list of publications. If you go there, PDD, well, just type in UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And you'll get to there, to it. And I think over on the left side, there's a list of his publications that address, I think, all of the, and part of the extension. So you'll get good answers there.
Thank you, Larry. I forgot about that. And I use that all the time. They're very easy. Brian is excellent, like all of our extension specialists, in terms of clear directions. Here's what you're going to see. Here's what's affected. Here's some control options. And he often talks about non-chemical or organic solutions as well. And what's good is this is such timely, you know, it's timing is important and the right product is important to be effective. So I'm a believer that you need that information at hand so you can plan your schedule. But excellent. Thank you, Larry. I knew you could help me out on that one.
Okay. Tyson, thank you for calling. Stephen Appleton, we go to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was just wondering, you were talking about asparagus beds, if it would be too late to start one this fall.
I'm a person that pushes the limits, but typically we plant our asparagus in the spring. We buy in dormant crowns, or more and more garden centers are actually selling potted plants, a little pricier way to start. So we really want to get them established before winter. I have transplanted asparagus beds a couple times. Not something I'd recommend.
No.
It's a lot of work. And yes, and starting fresh with good, clean, certified, disease-free crowns or plants. You can get them 1 or 2 years. So unless there's a reason you have to move a bed and you're moving and selling the house, I would just, you know, start searching where you want to purchase, either your favorite local garden center or mail order catalog. There's some new great variety cultivars that are male out of New Jersey, out of Rutgers, like Jersey Giant, Jersey Knight, some out of Cornell. And the benefit of the male cultivars is they don't produce seeds, which then you'll have asparagus all over your property. And then the stems tend to be more robust but not tough. I have Jersey Giant, and the stems are pretty thick, but they're nice and tender and tasty. So I think start doing your research, you know. You probably want to do mail order unless you can find a local source, which is always great, and then start in the spring.
Good advice. Thank you very much for calling, Steve. Allison emailed about artificial light for annuals that come in from the outdoors. If Allison is using grow lights and putting them into a pole lamp, what colors should the bulbs be, red or green, and what's the best combination?
If you've got grow lights, they're a broad spectrum, so they're going to have all of the blue, the red, the green light that the plants need. There's a lot of research going on as we see more and more warehouse growing indoor food production. So if you've got a grow light, an LED, either get an LED full spectrum, then you've got it covered. The grow lights are full spectrum. They've really come down in price. The other thing with the LED lights is I'm finding and hearing from gardeners is our old recommendation of keeping plants, you know, for seedlings 6 inches above the top of the plant, 12 inches above growing plants. You may need to adjust the height because the LED lights, depending on them, can be so intense, it means you can keep them further away. So let your plants be your guide. If you've got compact, deep green, you know, kind of almost stunted growth, you may need to move those lights back. So I would look for a full spectrum LED light. They've come down in price. The energy efficiency is great, and they last a long time. And then I think, Larry, you started a trend. Everyone's looking for an old-fashioned pole light post and going to be adding their lights to it by their plants.
Well, you know, it works pretty good, and you need to kind of rotate the plant once in a while.
Good point.
But I thought it worked really good. I liked it a lot. Jane in Wausau emailed to say the leaves and branches on their tomato plants have turned yellow and brown and fall off mid-season. What's the best way to clean tomato cages and poles to prevent maybe this from happening next year?
Boy, I've read about this, and I think I should be better about doing it. I leave mine outside and hope the winter takes care of some of that. A lot of what will work, and from my understanding from Brian, and, you know, for disinfecting pots, we like to leave them soak for 10 minutes in a one-part bleach, nine-part water solution. I'm thinking I'm going to spray mine down with something like a disinfectant spray with a 70% alcohol, because that's more realistic of what could happen. You know, so as I finish cleaning out my tomatoes, I'm still harvesting some. As I finish cleaning them out, I'm going to spray down mine, because that's something I'm more likely to do. I don't know how I would soak my, you know, I need a big trough and, you know, and just real, I don't know, Larry, I'm kind of
I'd
showing
spray.
That I'm kind of a, yes.
Or and, just leave know, them outside all winter.
That's kind of what I've been doing, but I've got a few disease problems and I should be a good doobie. So thank you, Larry. I do. Mine just kind of sit out there for the winter. But, you know, if you're concerned, I think that's a great way to do it. You could get good coverage. It's relatively easy, right? If it's hard, we don't do it. And that's a disinfectant used in a lot of ways when we're dealing with cleaning our pruning tools, is using a disinfectant spray. So you've inspired me, Jane. I'm gonna make this the year that I actually treat my cages. So we'll compare notes next spring.
Sounds good. Monica emailed to say she thinks a previous caller, Eastern Snowball Bush, is really a Viburnum opulus. It is sometimes mislabeled as a hydrangea. Healthy ones can indeed get 10 to 12 feet tall.
You know what? Thank you so much, Monica. I thought because she threw hydrangea out, I just assumed it was a hydrangea, but you're right. There are snowball bush. Thank you so much for calling, Monica, and hopefully our previous listener, they got more information on hydrangeas than they needed. But that's a good point. And Viburnum opulus is the European cranberry bush viburnum, and it's invasive, so we don't want to use that anymore. Trilobum is also has the rounder flowers. It's our native. Both our native viburnums are susceptible to viburnum leaf beetle, so it's one of those to be careful if you're adding more to it. But Monica, thank you. And that would also explain some of the probably putting down the root growth at the expense of flowers. So Monica, thank you so much for catching that. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Monica. Dean emailed us to say every year they grow heavenly blue morning glories. This year they didn't get a single bloom. In spring, only one time, Dean gave them a shot of Miracle Grow. Dean suspects the nitrogen did in the blooms. Dean placed wood ash on the ground, still nothing. How can Dean prepare the soil for next year to get heavenly blue flowers?
Good question. So mine are blooming right now. I've been trying to get rid of my morning glories. They've been kind of taking over the garden. So I have the opposite problem, Dean. So morning glories, as you know, are late to bloom in the growing season. So heavenly blue tends to be an earlier bloomer, like early call. So if you're looking for flowers, you want to get one of the varieties or cultivars that tends to bloom earlier so you don't get flowers right before the first killing frost. Miracle-Gro is a fast-release, high-nitrogen fertilizer, and so you always want to be aware. One application probably shouldn't have been a problem, but morning glories are pretty luxury feeders, right? So you don't need to fertilize much. Wood ash does have phosphorus, but it does tend to elevate our pH, so it doesn't improve drainage. So be careful if you have high alkaline soil, adding wood ash is not a good idea. And so it's not really going to help promote bloom. As you know, I'm a fan of malorganite because when the microorganisms work on releasing the nutrients from the pellets, it releases some of the phosphorus. We tend to have high excessive levels, good for flowering and fruiting, but it's been tied to our soil. So the microorganisms help release it, make it available to the plant. So, or use an organic fertilizer if you're not comfortable with malorganite, because we tend to find more microbial activity. And I think doing that once in the spring, preparing the soil, and then I would avoid, unless your plants show nutrient deficiency, I'd avoid any additional fertilizer. And I think you should have good luck. It's, you know, it's a hot summer. And, you know, it's weird. I don't know if you noticed this, but I had plants that weren't blooming well when it got really hot and they were struggling. And as soon as we got a cool spell, they really took off. Things that normally perform well in our summers, it was just pretty hot for some plants this year.
Before we take some more questions, Melinda, I wanted to get to your webinars. You mentioned webinars earlier in the show. Do you have any webinars coming up for us?
You know what? I did my last one in September, and it was on fall landscape planting and care. So it's one that you may want to reference as you're thinking about what you need to do before you close out. I will just, in the last moment, signed up to be part of the Milwaukee Urban Ag Conference. It's being held at Vincent High School. It's a free event. I'm just going to have a booth and answer questions in the afternoon. I was a speaker there last year, and it's a lot of people from Southeast Wisconsin who are doing agriculture in an urban environment. They've got some keynote speakers that are doing amazing things. They've got workshops on things like hydroponics, soil testing basics, urban pollinators, and native plants. I was able to clear my schedule and join the event. So it's a free event. You might want to just look up Milwaukee Urban Ag Conference. It's Monday, so not a lot of notice, but if you have the day free, check it out. It's definitely worth attending. My webinars are available. And if anyone's in the area of Lake Bluff, Illinois, I'll be at Pasquazi Home and Gardens on November 8th talking about winter containers. It's hard to believe, but time to get those greens out and put them on your porch. Get the pumpkins off and put your greens on the porch for winter.
Okay. Dee in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I'm wondering about the practice of wrapping arborvitaes in burlap. I think it's burlap, some sort of brown paper, burlap something. Is it actually beneficial? And, you know, should we be doing it?
You know, great question. And I'm going to tell you, one of my pet peeves is we put evergreens in our yard to enjoy greenery all year, and then we wrap them in brown burlap. So the reason that's done is twofold. One is to protect them from winter winds that can be drying. So part of it is siting your evergreens correctly. You know, the first couple years as they're getting established, having a barrier if you've got, you know, severe wind, northwest winds coming through, those are very drying. The roots are frozen. They're still losing moisture through the needles. And so that's why a lot of people wrap them. The other reason people wrap them is to prevent deer damage, but also snow loads. Remember, two winters ago, we had that 16 inches of heavy snow, split a lot of upright junipers and arborvitae. Some survived, some had broken branches, some still have kind of a split growth. If you're concerned about that, if you have an arborvitae with multiple stems, I'd rather see you use something like bird netting. You can get the clear, you can get the black, and wrapping your plants with that. So if we do have a snow load, or use cotton strips or strapping to loosely tie those branches together. I do some work at We Energy Energy Park where I speak every year, and we had Crawford Tree Care helped us with some work getting the gardens ready a couple of years ago, and they tied up our arborvitae. You couldn't even see the straps they used. And then that next winter, we had those heavy snow loads. And fortunately, they had done that. Our arborvitae were fine. So if they're a new planting, if it's subject to winter winds, probably wasn't a good choice in the first place if you have to wrap them every year. If you're worried about snow and de-icing salt coming from the road, some people will put a barrier blocking that from reaching the plants rather than wrapping the plant itself. So you know, I kind of feel like we lose the benefit of an evergreen when we wrap it in burlap. So keep in mind, winter winds, is that an issue? De-icing salt and animals, and what's the best option for managing for those?
Perry and O'Connell, what's on your mind?
Hey, Melinda. I have a question about, for houseplants, can you recommend any kind of fertilizer for them and how often it should be used? I understand winter, you really don't want to use too much. And then the last real quick part is I have an aloe plant that is probably sticking out of the pot about 6 inches. And, of course, all the way up to the green part is just brownish stuff. Anything to replant that?
Okay.
Yeah, good question. Okay, so fertilizer. One of the things with houseplants, you're right, we don't want to fertilize typically November through March because they're not growing. Our goal is to get them through the winter. The days are gray, shorter, low humidity, and all of that. So thank you for mentioning that, Perry. I'm a big fan of low nitrogen, slow release fertilizers. Melora aconite is not something most people want to put on their houseplants because it has that organic smell to it. I'll often go to, I don't have a favorite. I tend to be an under-fertilizer on my houseplants. They're pretty much the size I want them. If you do a high nitrogen, fast release fertilizer, just dilute it because you can always add more. Everything I read talks about fertilizing every couple weeks or once a month, and I'm like, wow, that's a lot of fertilizer. I'd rather err on the side of less. So depending on your philosophy, you might want to look for one of the, there's a lot of organic fertilizers out on the market that are low nitrogen, slow release. Or if you do a high nitrogen, fast release, just dilute it because you can always add more. So how's that for? And then fertilize based on the amount of growth you want, right? My houseplants do pretty well with a benign neglect. And so I don't fertilize a whole lot, maybe a couple times during the growing season if needed. Your aloe plant, I'm guessing the older leaves kind of fell off, and I'm looking at my aloe plant, and there's all that dried base of the leaves on the stem. It's kind of typical of how they grow, and so often they'll send offshoots. I've got a couple offshoots coming off of my plant, so that helps mask those brown stems. I'm guessing that's it. If the soil has settled, and that was the former soil line, you can, you know, add a little soil at the surface. Often it sinks. Patty Nutguy, who a lot of you know, who's been a regular guest of yours, she talked about putting floral foam in the bottom, in the drainage holes of your houseplant container. So it still lets the water leak out, drain out, but it prevents the soil from going out. I use coffee filters, and then occasionally I just have to lift my plants and add some more soil after a couple of years. So I think without seeing it, Perry, I'm guessing it's just where the old leaves came off your aloe plant. You could try cutting it and trying to root it, let it superize, callus over for a couple of days, put it in a well-drained cacti succulent mix, just very ever slightly. Don't want to let it go as dry as you normally would to get those roots to form, but you could do a cutting from it as well and then try to root along the stem.
There you go, Perry. And I guess there we go, Melinda. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. It's always such a pleasure. And you'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
I would love it. Thank you so much, Larry. You have a good rest of your day.
Melinda Myers, our guest. Go to her website, Melinda Myers spelled M-E-Y-E-R-S. She has a lot of great information on that website. And especially, you might want to take a look at copies of some of her past webinars while you're at it. Coming up, we're going to talk about seed saving with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to seed saving. Our next two guests have been growing their own food and saving seeds for about 25 years. And in 2022, they founded Oshkosh Seed Savers. And we're going to talk to them about the organization. With us, Jason Mills and Julia Chabowski. Jason has a PhD in botany, studied plant community ecology. He's taught at a university level, now manages his non-commercial organic urban micro farm. And Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Appreciate having you with us. Julia Chabowski has a PhD in musicology, a professor at UW Oshkosh. Julia, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about seeds, saving seeds, or maybe forming a seed collective? Are you wondering how to save those seeds from your garden? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, talk@wpr.org. What was the spark that inspired you to found Oshkosh Seed Savers?
I can start with that. Yeah. Well, if you remember kind of the mode we were all in 2022, we're trying to crawl out of pandemic mode. And we were noticing a lot of rising interest in gardening. And Jason and I, you know, as you mentioned, we had been growing our own food and saving seeds for a long time. We were connected with the national organization, Seed Savers Exchange, based in Iowa, and we traded seeds through that network. But we knew the value of locally adapted seed, and we wondered if there were seed savers in our area. We assumed there were, and we just thought, well, how can we build up a local network? So we said, okay, we're going to host a seed swap in the driveway, and we just tried to get the word out. It was real grassroots, people came. And then we did it. It was in the spring, and then we did another in the fall, and we did spring and fall for a few years. And through that, we did meet some really experienced seed savers in our area. You know who you are, Celia, Chris. Some of these folks had, you know, much more experience than we did, and they've brought a lot to this organization. But besides those really experienced seed savers, we met some hundreds, actually, of people who were enthusiastic but didn't have the experience in seed saving, and a lot of people who thought gardening and growing their own food was a good idea, but they were novices, absolute novices. And so all of those folks have shaped the organization. Right now, our mission is to curate and maintain a locally adapted seed collection from which we share seeds freely. And then there's an educational piece. So we do a lot of we produce educational materials. We do a lot of hands-on demonstrations to support the idea of growing your own food.
Wow, that's a lot. Jason, how do you keep this going? Is this a commercial venture in any way?
It's not at all commercial. All of the seed that we share with people, we share that freely. So we rely on donations and volunteers who help us manage our field site. We have, this season, three gardens where we are growing seed to share with our community. Our backyard garden we've been using that for quite a while now. It's extensive, and it's obviously very convenient for us to work there. So we produce some seed in our backyard garden. We have a friend who has some garden space not too far from us. She's allowing us to grow a few seed crops there. And then we have another friend on the edge of Oshkosh who has a very large property, and it affords us pretty good isolation for many of the crops. We have about 3,000 square foot plot out there where we grow many different seed crops. And so the work is spread across these three different locations. And I think for the large field plot, at least, we rely on volunteers to help us do things like weeding, tending the plants, harvesting, for seeds. And then I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago, we had a big seed cleaning party in our driveway where we invited members of our group to come over, and people just helped us process all of these fruits to free up the seeds from the fruits so that we can later on package those and distribute those.
That sounds like a messy proposition. Describe describe a little bit, maybe, Julia, how that works.
The seed cleaning?
Yeah.
Well, there's wet seeds and dry seeds, right? Dry seeds are like shelling beans, like shelling legumes. We do a lot of legumes of different species. So just shelling the dry legumes. And, you know, that's the table that everyone goes to first. It's kind of like tangible and fun, you know, people chatting while they do it. You know, twisting the corn, you know, shelling corn, twisting the kernels off the cobs. And then the messy part is we set up a makeshift outdoor sink. The messy ones are eggplant. You know, you gotta get in there and squeeze out the slimy seeds from what are overgrown by harvest standards fruits, right? So it can be messy, but you know, it's fun and a lot gets done in an afternoon.
How many people are involved? If you think about the whole process, how many people get involved in this?
Well, we had at our last spring seed swap, we had about 100 people come to share seed and get seed from us. At the plant share we did, we had about 100. The volunteers that help us run that field site Jason mentioned, we've got about 20 volunteers that come periodically. So that gives you a sense. And we're connected with about 230 all total in the Fox Valley. So
on your website, you say that you maintain and distribute locally adapted varieties that are culturally important to the history, historical and current inhabitants of the region. Talk about the idea behind that. Both of you could comment.
Yeah, maybe I'll start, Jason, and then I'll pass it to you. But I should say first that Oshkosh and the Fox Valley in general has been a resettlement site for refugees for a long time, and it's actually a very, very culturally diverse place in terms of where people are coming from and what they're bringing. And we understand food as culture, right? And so, especially for newcomers, we realize the importance of being able to share produce that they recognize from home. And this produce is very often not available at the farmers markets or in the grocery stores or at the food pantries, right? So I'm talking about Nana Chungo eggplant, an African eggplant, Holmes Syrian summer squash, for example, Karini peppers from Myanmar. So part of our project has been to source seeds from the global regions that newcomers have come from see if they can grow here. And this is where Jason's background in botany really helps out. You know, often we get seeds and they don't grow very well here at first. But if we can get a crop to the seed stage, if we can harvest some seed, then we have now selected for local adaptation. And so if we can get anything at all, then we grow it again the next year. And again and again, and after a few years, you have a population of seed that will grow here. So we're kind of teaching these global crops to grow here. And then there's that connection to that's our community building, right? Because these crops are connected to the people that live here. And it's tremendously satisfying to be able to share produce and then seeds so that these crops can be grown here.
Yeah, it's really cool. Jason, you want to add to this?
I guess I might add about a little bit about the adaptation part of the process. So as Julia mentioned, we maybe in year one try to get some seeds from a new variety. If we do get those seeds, I will replant those the following year. And again, some plants will die, others will survive and make seed, and then we save those and replant those. And that process we repeat year after year. So the idea for our entire collection is, I think, centered on that process where we are producing seeds that should do well in Oshkosh and the surrounding area because all of those seeds are grown here. And this is in contrast to maybe many of the seeds that gardeners encounter, which they find at a hardware store or they order online from a seed company, in many cases, it's not clear where those seeds were grown. They could have been grown in a place which is very different from Wisconsin in terms of the soil, the pests, the climate. And so when people plant those seeds here, they usually work out okay, and you get, you know, tomatoes or cucumbers or whatever. But we like to produce locally grown seed that we believe in the longer term will give you better results.
Yeah, it's an amazing process that you're doing. Talking with Jason Mills and Julia Chabowski, founders of the Oshkosh Seed Savers Collective. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Talking today with the founders of the Oshkosh Seed Savers Collective, Jason Mills and Julia Chabowski. A very successful effort in my mind, and I think a lot of people's mind, to save seeds, and also the concept of locally grown seeds. That's really important from the sound of it, Jason.
It is. A lot of commercial seeds are produced in places that are different from Oshkosh or wherever you might live in Wisconsin. So if you're saving seeds in your own garden and planting those out year after year, you should be developing a population that does very well in your garden. So I think the locally produced seed is, all things equal, that's going to be the way to go.
How many events do you host each year, maybe, and talk about those events?
Sure. Julia? Sure, I can take that. So we're still growing, you know, organically, if you'll excuse the pun, but, you know, we're trying to cater to what our community wants and what people want to be involved in. So it's about six or so events a year. Our big annual event now is the spring seed swap. And if folks want to keep an eye out for that, we welcome absolutely anyone. We host it in a public place. Now, these days, we've moved out of the driveway, Larry, as you got to say. We've moved out of the driveway. We host it in a public place indoors. People want it indoors because we aim for the first weekend in March. So I don't have quite the date and location set yet, but first weekend in March. And folks can get in touch with us if they want to be coming to that. So that's the big one. Then throughout the growing season, we have hands-on demonstrations where we'll show what people are asking us for. So these vary. They're real seed saving things. So we do like how to save seeds from squash, for example, and we show people how that looks, and people do it with their hands, and then they give them a handout. So they have the written instructions and then they've done it. So it really can be meaningful for folks. We also, so the hands-on demonstrations in the garden, and then the seed cleaning event, which we mentioned earlier in your show, that where we all get together in the fall. We just did this a couple weeks ago, and we see. So basically, our events are mostly, in the garden, like hands-on, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like learn by doing events. You know, they're not lectures where we stand and tell people stuff. We want them actively involved.
So somebody else wants to know more about the seed swap and what it looks like. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I sure can. Whether it was in the driveway or in the public library, which is probably where we'll be this year, but we set up a bunch of tables. We have greeters at the front end to kind of help people get oriented. We have a zone for if you're bringing seeds to donate, either commercial seeds that are extra to you or seeds you've saved yourself. We have a certain area for that to leave. People just drop off and then other people pick up. It's just kind of a free-for-all zone, right? Then we have the Oshkosh Seed Saver seeds. So those are packaged with some instructions. We have more information about all of those on our website. So that looks a little bit more commercial, but again, it's all free. So we just, this is volunteer powered and we run on donations. So those are available for free. People take them and often people leave a donation, right? Because they figure, well, I'd be buying seed anyway somewhere else. So that often works really well. Then we usually have a couple of zones for just some aspects of education related to seed saving. And there's our other tables that where people come, a lot of now we've connected with people who have extensive collections of their own that they want to share from. So people will set up with their own table and they'll have bowls and jars full of seed and we package as they are needed. So it looks kind of like a fair, you know, like a like a seed fair, I guess.
It's pretty cool. How many varieties of seeds do you, the two of you, produce in a year through your various plots?
Well, in every year, it might be maybe about 30. Does that number sound right, Jason?
It does,
But then our entire collection, we're about to take on quite an extensive collection from one of these longtime seed savers that we've been friends with now, that we've met through this process. And so by next spring, we're going to have about 250 varieties that we maintain. And those are already locally adapted varieties.
Wow.
But those aren't going to be grown out every year. So that's why, you know, we're going to be growing out maybe between 50 and 80 different varieties every year, like on a rotation to keep the seed viable.
So this is, I'm trying to picture the plots and people drive by and they talk about the plots themselves.
Jason, you want to talk about the field site out on 20th?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have, as I mentioned earlier, a pretty large plot on the edge of town. Thank you to Jim, if you're listening. And it's going to be fenced next year. We received a grant recently from the Canary Fund in the Fox Valley, which will allow us to put up a deer fence around this garden, which is important. There are deer which would otherwise eat our plants. But if you looked inside of this garden, what you would see is a very diverse looking garden. I suppose it looks like most backyard gardens, although it's maybe bigger, and we have a larger variety of plants out there. And depending on the time of year that you visit this garden, you might also notice many of the plants are underneath a fine mesh netting. And the reason for that is we need to control what plants can cross with the other plants. So we may be maintaining, for example, multiple varieties of pepper or multiple varieties of eggplant. And because insects can carry pollen between all of those plants, all the pepper plants or all the eggplants, we need to control which plants are allowed to cross with one another. And so the netting helps us exclude pollinators, and then we have to either hand pollinate or allow the plants to self-pollinate. It depends on the species, but those nets will kind of protect these plants from pollinators. Usually by midsummer, those nets come off and then everything is simply allowed to grow. And maybe later in the season, our seed garden starts to look a little different from a typical backyard garden in that some of the plants are allowed to proceed well into their life cycle, basically completing their life cycle, whereas many backyard gardeners would not allow that to happen. So they're going to harvest the crops that they want for food, and then they're done with those plants, and they might remove those. But for us, we leave things in the garden usually as long as possible because we want the fruits to get really big. And within those fruits, we've got these seeds, and we want those to get really big and develop fully so that they're mature when we harvest them from the plants. So to give you maybe a more concrete example, eggplants are harvested for food at a relatively early stage. You know, just imagine your sort of glossy, dark purple eggplant. That's usually when we would harvest that for eating. if we want to collect seed from an eggplant, that eggplant would be on attached to the plant for probably at least a 4, maybe 6 weeks, maybe up to 8 weeks beyond the typical harvest stage. And in that time, it's going to continue to grow. It's going to get a little bit bigger. Its skin will turn dull. It frankly doesn't look very appealing as a food thing. And then, of course, if you were to cut it open, you would see all of these tiny brown seeds in there, which usually we don't see that in an eggplant that you're going to, let's say, chop up and cook for eating. The same goes with something like cucumbers. If you maybe you've sort of missed a cucumber in your backyard garden at some point and it's gotten very large, that's actually our goal. If we're producing cucumber seeds, we want to have really huge inedible eggplant fruit, or sorry, cucumber fruits, because they're going to have big fat seeds inside. And those are the seeds that are really valuable when it comes to propagating the plant.
So if you've got, so if you miss one in the garden, you might go ahead and save that and use it the next.
Well, no. Maybe. It depends, Larry. It depends on the species, right? Here's where the isolation distance, Jason's talked a little bit about this, but with something like cucumber, if that's our example, the cucurbits, so cucumbers, melons, squashes, pumpkins, the insects pollinate and cross-pollinate those very easily. And so in an urban setting, it is unlikely for you to be able to save seeds from that cucumber and grow them to produce fruits that look like the original. It's unlikely because the bees probably cross that. It can be up to a half a mile that they've crossed. So even if it's the only cucumber you grew, your neighbors may have grown, right? You don't have control over that. So that's where the isolation methods come into play, where we can't use distance in the city to isolate the crops of the same variety. So we have to use barriers like netting or something.
So the area in which you guys work, I mean, what would you, how would you describe, you know, if I was going to go to one of your seed events, and I'm sitting in Madison, would those seeds be okay for Madison?
They probably would. Your growing conditions are quite similar to ours. Yeah. I mean, just that when Jason was talking about commercial seed grown, potentially somewhere with very different conditions, we're thinking like a lot of the commercial seed in the U.S. is grown in the Pacific Northwest. So that's very different, right? So the difference between Oshkosh and Madison is nothing compared to the distance between, you know, difference between Wisconsin and Washington State, for example.
So, you know, probably from most areas, or at least many areas of our state, those seeds would work really well.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. Although it does seem to me that Oshkosh, it does have a different climate from Madison.
Yeah.
Whenever I look at the radar, it seems like Madison in the summer is getting rain. And this summer, at least, we didn't get many of the storms that did hit Madison. So we're actually pretty dry up here right now in Oshkosh, whereas Madison tends to be wetter.
Maybe a little
summer.
Moister. Yeah.
Depends on the year, of course.
You know, and what? I'd be willing to give it a try.
It'd be worth trying.
I think you should.
I've got to come up and visit you guys. And if you go to the Oshkosh Seed Savers Collective, you just type that into the website.
It's OshkoshSeedSavers.org.
OshkoshSeedSavers.org. It has been a pleasure talking with you both. Thanks for the work you're doing. It's really important work, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It's very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jason Mills and Julia Chabowski, founders of the Oshkosh Seed Savers Collective. They're doing some really fascinating and worthwhile work for folks here in our state. Pleasure to have them with us. And a pleasure to have you listening in today, and a pleasure to have a team that we have here at WPR. For this show, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, all part of it, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.